I wanted to bring your attention to something, and I have a subject I want to talk about that I think is going to be very appropriate, especially in light of that long list of individuals requesting prayer. Because today I want to spend a little time talking about prayer and just how important it is. You know, this last week was a day of prayer. It was the National Day of Prayer this last week, and it kind of brings full circle some, certainly, I think, concerns about prayer that, frankly, our secular society in many regards is far too cavalier about this habit that should be, brethren, as regular as your eating habits. These are spiritual eating habits that are very important for your spiritual growth and your diet. I want to bring your attention to some things before I, though, get started with this, because I think some of us forget some things regarding prayer. Do you realize that there were over 1,700 prayer proclamations between the years 1633 and 1812 by the colonies here in the United States. And those prayer proclamations, 1,700 of them, were issued by none other than the governors of those colonies and of those what were called at that time provinces and or slash states. Amazing. Amazing. In 1952, many of you perhaps already know this, but what happened was Harry Truman, good old Harry, he went ahead and signed into law the Day of Prayer back in 1952. And that Day of Prayer has gone uncontested, pretty much, until the latest U.S. District Federal Judge, Barbara Crabb, I can kind of understand why she's a little crabby, perhaps, decided to claim that prayer was unconstitutional in the United States of America. And as a result, attempted to try to extrapolate it and claim that it was illegal to engage in a day of prayer in the United States of America. And to the credit of our current president, Barack Hussein Obama, he overruled her proclamation. He did. Now, unfortunately, he himself didn't plan any kind of special event at the White House, didn't have any kind of special notification or announcement or heralding of any sort that the day was any different. But the fact of it is, he did overrule her statement. Now, contrary to the current president's statement about the United States of America not being Christian, the fact of it is, a day of prayer is very consistent with the United States' origins and the original intent of the Protestant forefathers in their establishment of the United States to be a Christian nation, regardless of what the present president's opinion might be concerning that. I want to take some time here today before I get into illustrating just how important prayer is, to illustrate how important prayer was to our forefathers. I want to share some quotations with you to illustrate and substantiate my point that the United States of America was indeed originally intended to be established on Christian, Protestant, Judeo ethics. It's important, I think, all of us understand these things because this is documented history, brethren. This is real stuff. And so much today is attempting to be rewritten and or even denied. Come on, the United States of America is not a Christian nation? Baloney, balderdash, a few other words you could say along with that, especially in light of and in face of the history of our United States. I quote to illustrate what I'm talking about. The distinguished, and I'm quoting, character of a patriot. It should be our highest glory to add the more distinguished character of a Christian. I'm still quoting. This is one of our forefathers. Listen to these words. The signal instance of providential goodness which we have experienced and which we have now almost crowned our labors with complete success, demand from us in a peculiar manner the warmest returns of gratitude and piety to the supreme author of all good, unquote, George Washington. Oh, it gets better. Oh, my, look. There are so many. I could actually spend probably an hour up here quoting just from many of the documents of our forefathers. Notice this one. John Hancock, Massachusetts, calling for a state of prayer, and I break into the context, that the universal happiness may be established in the world and that all may bow to the scepter of our Lord. This is John Hancock. May bow to the scepter of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the whole earth be filled with his glory, unquote. That's John Hancock. John Adams, listen to this. The general principles, and I'm quoting now, on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. This is John Adams talking. This is a quote. I will avow that I then believed, and now believe, that those general principles of Christianity. He's using the word, Christianity. Values, ethics, standards, what the book says about Christianity, and I go back quoting now, are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God. The Christian religion is above all the religions that ever prevailed or existed in ancient or modern times. The religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. Suppose a nation in some distant region should take the Bible for their only law book and every member should regulate his conduct by the precepts there exhibited. What a utopia! What a paradise would this region be? Unquote. John Adams. Wow. Can you imagine one of our leaders talking like this today? Samuel Adams. No connection to the beer, by the way. Again, calling for prayer in the state of Massachusetts. Quote, we may with one heart and voice humbly implore his gracious and free pardon through Jesus Christ. This is Samuel Adams. I mean, he's saying the name. Through Jesus Christ, he says, supplicating his divine aid, and above all, to cause the religion of Jesus Christ in its true spirit to spread far and wide till the whole earth shall be filled with his glory. These are our forefathers, brethren, talking like this. Here's another one, Jefferson. No, the Anglican, suspicious, somewhat doubtful on occasion, but nevertheless, a Christian Anglican, Jefferson, he says, I am a Christian. That's what he said. You don't hear too much about this. You always hear some spin sometimes that Jefferson was a deist, you know. Well, Franklin was a deist, but Jefferson wasn't a deist. He was an Anglican. Here he says, I'm a Christian. In the only sense in which he wished anyone to be, I'm quoting now, sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others, I am a real Christian, that is to say, a disciple of the doctrines of Jesus Christ, unquote. Thomas Jefferson. That's what Thomas Jefferson said. Here's another one. Now, he's a deist, of course, I'll agree, and I'll concede to that, Benjamin Franklin. But even Benjamin Franklin, in his educated opinion, very wise man, this time late in his life, states this, as to Jesus of Nazareth, and I'm quoting, as to Jesus of Nazareth, I think the system of morals and his religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is indeed likely to see, unquote. And he was a deist, admitted deist, meaning basically he was an agnostic. He believed in God. He just didn't know what God it was he was believing in, but he believed in a God, you know. This same guy, Benjamin Franklin, on the date of June 6th, was it? I think it was June 6th. No, June 28th, 1787, in the meeting of the Constitutional Congress in Philadelphia in that year in 1787, They were at an impasse. Everybody, all the delegates, they were hot-tempered. It was a hot day in June. They were all at each other's throats. They were going at it like a couple of cats on a hot tin roof. They couldn't get anywhere. They were stuck in the mud. There were even speeches, you can go back on it, which said basically that America was on the precipice of total, complete annihilation. It wasn't going to exist. It wasn't going to survive. And they were there that day in an attempt, and actually for quite a few months, trying to get the Articles of Confederation moved to where they would begin to develop and mature into what we understand to be our Constitution. We were at, that is, those delegates at that time, on that June 28th, 1787, were at an impasse. They were loggerheads. They could not move. They were basically at a stumbling block. Everybody was just arguing with one another. And finally, Franklin stood up. And he gave a presentation from the heart. I bet if I took a poll, none of you, or very few of you, would have ever even, number one, known of this presentation I'm about to share with you that moved that Constitutional Congress off the impasse, or perhaps, secondly, ever read it. Because in most cases, it has been kept undercover because of what it has said and what it implies. But let me quote some portion of it from this particular book called The Book That Made America. This particular book, The Book That Made America, on page 223. I'm not going to have time to read the whole speech, but I am going to break into the close as he concludes, that is, Benjamin Franklin concludes. He addresses the president of the Congress, and he says, "Mr. President," and he proceeds then to lay out some things that sets it up, and finally, he's making, as they would say, rounding third and heading home here to conclude this presentation. And it's an appeal. It's not a prayer. It was a presentation. It was a speech. It was an appeal to men of level heads, of more, what you could say, tempered minds to rule and to be basically in control. He says here, "I have," and I quote, "I have lived, sir, a long time. The longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth." Here's the truth he states, quote, "that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid?" Talking, of course, in the framing of 1787, this was the emergence of the United States of America attempting to mature into a full-blown nation with a full-blown constitution that is an outgrowth of the Article of Confederation, Articles of Confederation. He goes on, and I quote here, and I continue, "We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings," again, the framing, the sacred writings were not the Koran. The sacred writings are the Bible, is the Bible, I should say. And he goes here and he says, "I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. We shall be divided by our partial local interests, our projects will be confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and a byword down to future ages. And what is worse, mankind hereafter, from this unfortunate instance, despair of establishing governments by human wisdom and leave it to chance, war, and conquest. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business, and that one or more of the clergy of this city," that city being Philadelphia, "be requested to officiate in that service." He further states, and he says, that the Lord, he says here in the sacred writings, that if the Lord, except the Lord build the house, they that labor in vain that build it, unquote. So said Benjamin Franklin in his appeal toward the Constitutional Congress in their efforts to try to get beyond this impasse. From that point on, they began to open their meetings every time with a prayer. And from that point on, it's documented. This is documented history. I'm not making it up. Attitudes changed. attitudes changed to the point where they became cooperative, and guess what they accomplished? Look bad. They accomplished America, the United States of America. And for the last 223 years since then, things have been kind of going okay. I mean, yeah, we've had our ups and downs, two world wars and so forth, but in all due respect, the Constitution did get written. Not that it is a panacea to the problems of the world, or for that matter, to even our own society, but it was enough to get our nation off that impasse and to develop into what many of us have been beneficiaries of for many, many years. And I say that to say this, because in addition, from that point on, there were additional things that illustrate, and again, I'm trying to make this case and trying to illustrate a point, that beyond a shadow of a doubt and without question, the United States of America was intended originally to be built on Christian Judeo ethics, to commence its social endeavors in developing a society around those particular principles. You can go back, and again here, I have a copy of one of the United States' first school textbooks. It's called the New England Primer. This book was used almost 200 years in educating our youth. And it basically states this as far as the introduction to this New England Primer. The contents of this present edition, with the exception of the foreword, is a reproduction of the 1777 New England Primer. The New England Primer, introduced in Boston in 1690 by Benjamin Harris, was the first textbook printed in America. You know what's in this book? They taught our kids how to read by reading the Bible. That's how they taught our kids. In 1690, from that point on, for 100 years after its introduction, the New England Primer was the beginning textbook for students until 1900. It continued to be the principal textbook in all types of American schools, public, private, semi-private, parochial, etc. The founders, as well as most other Americans, learned to read from the New England Primer and the Bible. Those were the two major textbooks of the American society in the commencement of this great nation. In addition, in 1842, George Washington's biography was written, and it was written by a lady named Anna C. Reed, who was the niece of one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and this book was written in 1842. It too, this particular book, the biography of George Washington, is essentially the first biography of such, and was promoted by the American Sunday School Union, later on changed name to the American Missionary Fellowship, and was essentially also the textbook that was put into the saddlebags of horseback riders who went and delivered this book after it was printed to every church and single schoolhouse in the United States to be used in conjunction with the primer and the Bible, illustrating the principles of biblical and Christian ethics that George Washington and his mother taught him. You know the story about the cherry tree and all of that stuff? And George Washington never lied? And the fact of all these things that you hear when you were a kid about George Washington? They're in this book. And the fact of it is, I don't know how the story ever got kind of skewed a little bit about the cherry tree, but the original story in this 1842 book was about him throwing a hatchet and knocking off a piece of the cherry tree, not cutting the cherry tree down. There's a better story in here about his mother, who had a prize colt, and George, 15 years old, who essentially wanted to basically train that colt because it was still a wild horse. Nobody had ever mounted it and rode it. And George Washington, already being quite a horseman at 15, because many of you, perhaps if you know anything about George Washington, he was quite a horseman. And he and his buddies, 15 years old, they got up real early in the morning, took that colt actually out in the back into a corral, and he attempted to put bridle on it so that he could mount it. He went ahead and he got on it, and he was trying to break it, and it was trying to buck him off and all this, you know, and all get him off the back, and the horse dropped dead. It died. It burst a vein, had a heart attack. And so then all of a sudden his mother says, George, breakfast! George and his buddies went in for breakfast and they sat around the table. And she said, because apparently she'd always see the horse in the morning out in the corral by the barn, she asked him point blank, has anybody seen my colt this morning? But George, true to the reputation that he had, that he never told a lie, was actually very truthful. He said, Mom, the horse is dead. Just like that. And in the book it says, essentially, that her face got real red. And she looked like she was going to pop and burst the bubble. And then she finally said, well, that may be so, but at least I'm encouraged over the fact that my son told me the truth. It's kind of neat stories. Real life stories. These stories stuck because these were real events in the life of George Washington. George Washington had the reputation at school that if somebody said, George says it's true, then it was believable. It was believable. That's in the book. That's in the book because that was the record and the reputation of our father of this particular country, the first president of the United States. Why do I say all this? Because, brethren, prayer was a very major element in the establishment of this country, and it is a very, should be, major element and exercise in our lives, especially in today's day and age, because we are living in some very treacherous, tumultuous times. We need prayer in our lives. And there are other examples, far more, hopefully, meaningful to us in the life of Jesus Christ that I want to share with you here over the remaining minutes that I have left. Turn with me, if you would, to Matthew chapter 14. Matthew chapter 14. Jesus Christ, in this particular situation, comes to find out that the Baptist, John the Baptist, was beheaded. His disciples went ahead, got the body, verse 12, and buried it, and went and told Jesus. Verse 13 of Matthew 14, and in verse 13, Jesus, when he heard it, he departed thence by ship into a desert place apart. Jesus often went to desert places. He often went off by himself. As you will come to see in these other instances that I'm about to share with you, those times when he was off by himself, he often found himself praying. As you go down here through this particular context in chapter 14, you will see the story changes to the situation of where he begins to feed 5,000 men besides women and children, verse 21. Could have been maybe easily 10,000 people at this gathering when Jesus fed these people with very limited amounts of fish and, needless to say, very limited amounts of bread. At any rate, all of these people were spending time there at this time with this particular event. And here you see in verse 23, when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain apart to pray. And when the evening was come, he was there alone. Jesus often, you will see throughout the Bible, is described as a very praying person, committed to prayer. He found time to be alone, to talk to God, to share his life, his thoughts, his concerns, his worries, his anxieties with God. Luke 5, over here, Luke 5, and verses 1 through about 16 is a story that essentially is about his disciples and fishing and catching fish with Simon Peter and James and John, the Zebedee boys who were partners with Peter, because a lot of these guys, as you will come to find out, were actually family. There's a good case you could make in the Bible that John and James were Jesus' cousins, married to Mary's sister, but that's another story. The point here is that as you go down through these particular stories, you will see that he continues on in verse chapter 5, and finally here, going through this situation of healing a guy with leprosy and all, and again being involved in all these social events, verse 15, we drop down here to the context, in the context, but so much the more went there fame abroad of him. Great multitudes came together to hear and to be healed by him of their infirmities. He was building quite a reputation. He was building and becoming quite well known throughout the areas. In verse 16, and he withdrew himself into the wilderness and prayed. He had a very busy life. He had a lot of demands, a lot of obligations, a lot of sense of responsibility, with a lot of conditions and circumstances he found himself contending with and surrounded by. And it drained him. Have you ever been drained? Have you ever been really just wrung out because you've been just so busy? Running to and fro, or maybe you're heavy with anxiety? Maybe you're being overwhelmed by the stresses of your life? I mean, you go down and read through some of these experiences, and I'll tell you what, those words where Jesus said, "You who are heavy laden, come unto me, I'll give you rest." What's he telling you? What's he reminding you? When he says those words, what is he saying? He's saying, come unto me. How do you go unto Jesus, brethren? How do you go unto Jesus? You go unto him on your knees, do you not? You take some time. You pray. You pray about this country. You pray about safety. You pray that terrorists won't be successful in perhaps blowing up some of your loved ones who are unsuspected. You know, it takes real courageous people to blow up unarmed civilians, doesn't it? And I'm being facetious. Being facetious. We need to pray. We need to be a praying people very, very much. Mark chapter 1. Go back a few pages over here to Mark chapter 1. Here in this particular case, Mark chapter 1. And in verse 30, we break into the context. Simon Peter's wife. This is Peter. His wife's mother. This is Peter's mother-in-law. And again, I always often say, imagine that. The first pope was married. Peter, his mother-in-law. She was sick with fever. That was a joke, by the way. He came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and she immediately, the fever left her. She ministered unto them, gave them food and so forth. And at even when the sun did set, they brought unto him all that were diseased, them that were possessed with devils. The city was gathered together at the door. He healed many that were sick. Verse 34, now Mark chapter 1, with different diseases and cast out devils, suffered not the devils to speak. In other words, he prevented them from speaking. He didn't want to hear about him. Just told them to get out of there, you know, because they knew him. And he didn't want anybody, any demons recognizing or mentioning his name and all the things that went on with understanding who he was, because he still wanted to keep a very low-key operation in his ministry at this point. But be that as it may, he goes on here in verse 36, Simon and they that were with him followed after him, and when they had found him, they said unto him, go back up to 35. In the morning, after all that happened, in the morning, rising up a great while before day, he went out and departed into a solitary place and there prayed. And then that's when Simon went looking for him, followed him, and they found him praying. So here again, all these things going on, my point being, and here then Jesus breaking loose and going to pray. Prayer was a major part of Jesus' lifestyle. Prayer should be a major element in our lifestyle, brother. It really should. There are benefits in prayer, and that's where I'm going with all that I'm talking about in this particular case, because prayer does have a beneficial effect, or at least it should, on all of us. John 17 is really the Lord's Prayer. I'm not going to turn there, but I will bring your attention to that particular chapter. But Luke chapter 11, go there for a moment. Luke chapter 11, and in verse 1, look at this. And it came to pass that as he was praying in a certain place, when he ceased, when he finished, one of his disciples said unto him, Lord, teach us to pray as John, that's the Baptist, not the apostle, John the Baptist, also taught his disciples. So here apparently Jesus was within sight, he was within vision of these guys, watching him pray. When he finished, they asked him, hey, teach us how to do that. And, of course, you have the Lord's Prayer, what is coined as the Lord's Prayer, which is not the Lord's Prayer. John 17 is the Lord's Prayer. What we have here is the example or pattern of a prayer that is categorically divided in particular segments to give you an idea as the prayee or prayer to cover certain areas. You know, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. You understand that particular pattern. That's a pattern. That's not the Lord's Prayer. It's not to be intended to be memorized and repeated over and over and over. It's a prayer that shows you categories to cover. So if you ever get confused, go back to that, look at the categories, and then outline your presentation and your prayer accordingly. If you ever lost about how to pray, go back to the book of Psalms. There's well over 100 and what? How many chapters in the book of Psalms? 151, 52 chapters. That's 150 some prayers, different prayers that you can use as an example. That you can use as an example of ways to follow if you want to properly lay down your ideas and pray. Like I said, if you need ideas. Jesus prayed at Passover. He prayed before and after while he was on the stake. He was a constantly praying man. Jesus was. He prayed all the time. He was constantly aware of his Father. Notice this over here in John 11. This story always gets me, and I think sometimes we don't really catch it. This is the story of Lazarus. I use this in funerals quite a bit. But you will see something very interesting as he, Jesus, approaches where Lazarus is buried. He's entombed in this cave. And he's been there for, what, 3 days or so? Even Martha said, he stinks, Lord. You don't want to do this. He's not in really good shape to go ahead and raise him from the dead because he's kind of in a bad situation. He's been in there for three some days or so. You know, he probably is beginning to decompose is the point. Jesus comes up on the situation, he says here in verse 39, take away the stone. Martha, the sister, says, he was dead, says unto him, Lord, by this time he stinks, for he has been dead 4 days. I'm sorry, I said three. It's 4 days. Verse 40 now. Jesus says unto her, said I not unto you that if you would believe that you should see the glory of God? I always like to think about that. Could you imagine Jesus looking you eyeball to eyeball and telling you that? Martha, didn't I tell you? You want to see the glory of God? It kind of freezes me just to think about that. Him looking at me, you know, eyeball to eyeball. When he looked at Peter and he said, put your sword down. Boom. I mean, these are pretty heavy situations here. I like to stop and just pause and think about that. Verse 41, they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. Jesus lifted up his eyes and he said, now, many of us think, well, this is what he said, but it seems to me that basically what we've got here is the Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I'm not quite sure this is all he said, because this seems to be the conclusion. But regardless, here's the point. Verse 42. And I knew that you heard me always, but because of the people which stand by me or are around me, I said it, that they may believe that you have sent me. In other words, whatever he said for the reason, for the sake of the people around him, so that they could hear what he was saying, because he wanted them to know that what was about to happen was a God thing, that it came from God, and that it was from the Father, not even from Jesus. It was from the Father, because the Father heard him, that he, through Christ, raised Lazarus from the dead. And he says here, look at this in verse 43. And when he thus spoke, he cried with a megas. That's the Greek. That means he didn't say, Lazarus, 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 come out, wherever you are. He didn't say that. This word means it was loud. It was mighty. It was overwhelming. He screamed it. He yelled mightily. That's what this means. It was a loud yell of Lazarus' name. And as I've often characterized, Lazarus come hopping out because he was all wrapped up. And he came hopping out of that place, out of that tomb. Amazing, amazing. What have we just read here? Benefit number one. Benefit number one. All these examples, all the ones that I real quickly went through here, and I'm up against the clock already, but all these examples illustrate one thing. Benefit one. Prayer gets you close to God. If you think you're going to get close to God without making prayer a regular, steady habit in your life, you're fooling yourself. That's like saying you can eat ice cream for the rest of your life and not get fat. You're fooling yourself. You have got to have a healthy prayer life if you want a healthy relationship with God. So if you want to get close to God, benefit one from prayer will result in a closeness with God. But it comes through prayer. It comes through prayer. Prayer will generate a closeness to God, a sense, a notion, a feeling. We're feeling beings, brethren. It's important you feel close to God, that you not only know, but that you feel close to God. Prayer will help you in that area. We already touched on the second benefit, but I want to take your mind over here and bring your attention to Acts chapter 4. Acts chapter 4. This is a story, and it's always good to be familiar with the stories in the Bible, because guess what? These are not made up stories. These are stories of real events that dealt with real people that happened exactly the way they're described. And in the description of the events and the circumstances surrounding the conditions that you read in this Bible, with wherever you're reading, are illustrative of hopefully you getting information from, so that it will help you in your life to gain certain consciousness, a certain consciousness and awareness of God. Because these things really happen. Here in Acts chapter 4, notice, and in verse 13. Now, when they saw that the boldness of Peter and John perceived that they were unlearned and ignorant men, they marveled, they took knowledge of them, that they had been with Jesus. Now, this is the story, and I'll just put you into the context of the high priest and so on. And they basically arrested Peter, it was, I think, and John, and they had them incarcerated. And here in verse 13, Peter and John, they perceived that they were ignorant men. In other words, they weren't educated at Athens. They weren't educated at Alexandria. These were the schools of the, you know, the Yales and the Harvards of the day. These were fishermen. These were blue-collar workers. These were guys that perhaps didn't have the best vocabulary. They had, you know, verb and subject disagreements. They perhaps weren't the most eloquent speakers, but they spoke with passion. They were excited. They were committed and truly dedicated to what they were saying, and you could tell they were filled with their subject, because they were so enthusiastic and passionate. And in verse 15, we drop down. But when they had commanded them to go aside out of the council, they conferred among themselves. So they told John and Peter to get out. They wanted to, that is, these high priests and these religious leaders wanted to talk among themselves. And they said, verse 16 here, what shall we do with these guys? Verse 16, Acts chapter 4. For that indeed notable miracle has happened. They've done it. Is manifested. To all that are in Jerusalem, and we cannot deny it. If you want to find out what the miracle is and what caused John and Peter to be arrested, you go back to Acts chapter 3, where you find a guy who is there, and essentially he was at the porch over here at the temple, and he couldn't walk. Verse 7, chapter 3, the book of Acts, Peter said, look, I don't have any silver, I don't have any gold, but this I do, be healed in the name of Jesus Christ, he says, essentially lifts him up, and the guy starts walking around, leaping. Verse 8, he's leaping, standing, walking, entering into the temple. And of course, many people were amazed, verse 10, because they knew that this guy had been lame all his life. This was not some guy who was just, you know, kind of put there as a plant to make John and Peter look good so that they could get money from the audience. It wasn't that at all. This was a guy there that was for years that had the reputation of being lame. And as a result, it was known when he started walking around, whoa, a miracle happened. It could not be denied. And so fast forward over here to chapter 4, these particular guys that are bringing John and Peter under scrutiny are talking among themselves, saying, look, verse 16, and I'll reread it. What shall we do with these guys? For that indeed a notable miracle has been done by them and is manifest to all them that dwell in Jerusalem. We can't deny this. But that it spread no further among the people. Let's straightly threaten them. That's what we'll do. We'll threaten them. And then tell them that they shouldn't speak henceforth no more to no man in Jesus' name. That's what we'll do. Verse 18, they called them, commanded them not to speak at all, nor teach in the name. But Peter and John answered and said, look, whether it be right in the sight of God to hearken unto you more than unto God, judge you. For we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. Verse 21, now Acts chapter 4. So when they had further threatened them, they let them go, finding nothing how they might punish them because of the people. For all men glorified God for that which was done. For the man who was healed was in excess of 40 years old. This was no kid. It was no small little child, infant. This was a 40-plus year old man that was healed. So this was an obvious event that could not be denied and that a lot of people in the city of Jerusalem recognized because they knew who that guy was and they saw him there for years. And being let go, they went their own company. You can read on and read on, and then finally here we drop down to where I really want to go. I just wanted to kind of give you the gist of what's going on here. But in verse 27, we continue to read, "For of a truth against thy holy servant," the word child is actually a translation chosen by the translators. Servant would be probably a better Greek translation or English translation from the Greek, "whom you have anointed, both Herod, Pontius Pilate, and the Gentiles, the people of Israel will gather together for to do whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done. And now, Lord, behold their threatenings. Grant unto your servants that which all boldness, that they may speak your word by stretching forth your hand to heal, and the signs of wonders may be done by the name of your holy servant Jesus." And when they had prayed this, because this was when they were let go and they were at the house and they were talking amongst themselves, that is the disciples, the whole place shook. A miracle occurred again. The whole place shook, illustrating God's approval of what happened and their courage that was expressed. It was a dynamite event. Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. Talking about the second benefit. Haven't told you yet exactly what it is, but I want to show you what the second benefit is made up of. Here in verse 24 of chapter 8, the book of Romans. "For we are saved by hope. But hope that is seen is not hope. For what a man sees, why does he yet hope for?" I can't hope for the things that I already have. I can't hope for the car that I have because I have it. There's no sense in hoping for it anymore. I've got it. You know. But those things that I don't have, I hope for. In the context of what Paul is talking about in this particular case is obviously of a religious nature and talking about the resurrection and all the things that are associated with becoming a son of God. But the reality of it is, as we proceed here to identify what the second benefit is, part of it is hope. For verse 25, "If we hope for that we see not, then we do with patience wait for it. Likewise, the Spirit also helps with our infirmities. For we know not what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit itself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. And he that searches the hearts knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because he makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God." Your hope, brethren, can be made manifest through prayer. Why is that? Because in prayer, it should be what you're being told here, an intimate experience between you and your God. As a matter of fact, it ought to be so intimate that in some cases, you might not even have words to describe perhaps a need that you might have, perhaps a fear that you might be going through, perhaps a frustration or an anxiety. You don't have words to describe how angry you might be, or how upset you are, or how worried you are, or how much you need something. This is all part of that second benefit. It's all part of that second benefit. It's good to use prayer to hope for, and to help you to crystallize your hopes. James chapter 5, continuing here to substantiate what benefit 2 is, of which I have not yet told you. James chapter 5, and in verse 14 we read, "Is any sick among you? Let him call for the elders of the church. Let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord." And the prayer of faith, the prayer of hope, the prayer of belief. I hope you pray the names that were mentioned here. And I hope you hope and pray and believe that God's will be done in the lives of those people. And that perhaps he would be merciful enough to actually give them, and here it is, brethren, benefit number 2, miracles in their lives. Prayer generates miracles. And I dare say, I'm not going to ask for a hand raising, But I will raise my own hand. I've seen my prayers answered from time to time. I've seen miracles in my life happen. I've seen people's minds change. I've seen people heal. I don't think Kevin would mind. I don't think he would mind. But Kevin, Rick's stepson, when I saw him, what was it, about a year ago or so, Rick? I walked out of that hospital room personally. Shame on me. I constantly questioned my own faith in some cases, and this was one of those times. I walked out of there, I didn't think Kevin would be alive for 48 more hours. I thought he was a dead man. I walked in there, he was in liver failure, he was swollen like a big old balloon, yellow with jaundice, to the point where he looked yellowish brown. He was all backed up. He was in bad shape. Prayed, anointed him, walked out of that room saying, Father, even doubting my own faith. And we baptized him 2 weeks ago. He's alive. And he's working down in California building sheds. Amazing. Amazing. God be praised, right? God be praised for these kinds of miracles in the lives of people. And that's just one. That's just one. I know personally, and I could cite names in this room that I'm looking at where I know miracles in your life because I was, in some cases, privy to some of those events and conditions in your own lives. Brethren, benefit two is miracles do indeed happen, and they happen because you ask, you knock, you appeal, you implore. Ask, you shall receive. If don't ask, part of the lesson is to learn to ask. Learn to make God a part of your life. Granted, and I'd have to say this, I'm ashamed to say that sometimes I haven't prayed for something that I knew I really, really had to work out this way or I needed this. And guess what? It worked out that way. And I didn't pray about it. And all I can do is say, all right, I get the point. Because I got it anyway, you see. It worked out anyway. But you know what? I didn't pray about it. I should have prayed about it. I should have had God a part of it because guess what? He answered it anyway. It worked out the way I had hoped it would work out. You need to ask. You need to make God a part of you because you know what? I missed out on an opportunity to make God more real to me, see? To make God more real to me. I missed out on that opportunity to have Him inclusive in my own life in that regard. And that's important, brethren. That is very, very important that we pray and expect miracles. That's benefit two. Benefit two is when you pray, you can get miracles. You can expect miracles. Now, granted, don't get me wrong, you may not always get what you're asking for, but you will get what you need. You may not get what you want, but you will get what you need. And it's up to God to determine what you need over what you want. Because even what you might want may not really be good for you in the broad scheme of things. And God knows better. Therefore, you don't get necessarily, in this case, what you want. You get what you need. And what you need, maybe in that case, is not getting what you want. It could be that simple. It could be that simple. But benefit two is certainly miracles in one's life. And including God as part of that. Now, with that being said, however, there is something that as an adjunct to that is very important because it acts as a filter, a lesson, an additional need, ingredient. If you want miracles in your life, if you want your prayers answered, you need to do this as part of the makeup, as part of the makeup in you to better assure that you can maximize your requests. This is important. Matthew chapter 5. Verse 22. Jesus is talking here and he says, But I say unto you, whosoever's angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Whosoever shall say to his brother, You fool, you idiot, you jerk, you know. Boy, are you stupid, you dope, you know. And really mean it. And really mean it. I mean, you've casted that person off. That guy is worthless. Jerk. Dope. It's out of my life. I'm closing the gate on that person. They're out of it. Look what Jesus says. Shall be in danger of the council, but whosoever shall say, you fool, shall be in danger of Gehenna. Therefore, here's the solution. You want your prayers answered? You want to be in a better position to maximize miracles in your life? Miracles in your life? Look at this. Therefore, if you bring your gift to an altar, if you think you're going to give sacrifices to God, remember that you have aught against your brother. Verse 24. Leave what you think is good to God. Leave it. And go make up with your brother is what basically Jesus is saying. Get right with your fellow man, because as John said, if you can't even get along with those you see, who are you fooling that you can love me whom you can't see? You know, that's a pretty big indictment, or what you could say challenge, from the Apostle John. If you say you love God, then you ought to be able to love your neighbor as yourself. That's the challenge to all of us, you see. Over here in Mark chapter 11, perhaps it's better crystallized in this point, where Jesus says here in verse 22, have faith in God, for verily I say unto you, verse 23, Mark 11, that whosoever shall say unto this mountain, be you removed, and be you cast into the sea, and shall not doubt in his heart, but shall believe that these things which he has shall come to pass, he shall have whatsoever, he shall have whatsoever he says. Therefore I say unto you, what things soever you desire, when you pray, see, this is all about prayer. Connect the dots. This is all about prayer. When you pray, believe that you receive them. In other words, pray in belief, pray in hope. Remember, you read Romans chapter 8. Connect these dots. You pray in hope. You pray in hope because you don't have, so you're hoping for that which you don't have. That's what prayer's about. You're praying for something, some result, some objective, some goal, some need, whatever it may be, in your own self. Physically, spiritually, mentally, maybe for someone else, and hopefully more. So for that. But the point is that you're there in hope. He says here, Jesus does, therefore I say, verse 24, Mark 11, what things soever you desire, when you pray, believe that you receive them, and you shall have them. And when you stand praying, look at this. This is what I'm driving at. Jesus says, if you're going to pray and expect a miracle in your life, brethren, you've got to forgive. You've got to let your animosities, you've got to let your hate, your anger, you've got to release it. You've got to get rid of it. You've got to cut it loose, bury it, and move on. And if it takes talking to your brother, or it takes some kind of resolution, settling the lawsuit, whatever it may be. I'm just talking off the top of my head. But whatever it may be, once you do that, get it done, forgive and forget, and move on. Because that's the only way you're going to do it. If you're going to carry a lot of remorse, and a lot of pent-up anger, jealousy, envy, whatever those things may be, that may be the result of whatever the condition and situation may have generated, you're only doing yourself a disservice. You got to let it go. You got to let it go. Look at this. He says, forgive. If you have aught against any, that your Father also, which is in heaven, may forgive your trespasses. Verse 26, here's the barometer. Here's the reciprocation. Verse 26, but if you do not forgive, neither will your Father, which is in heaven, forgive your trespasses. It's reciprocal. If you want to be forgiven, forgive. Be a forgiving person. That's the key. So that's the second benefit. That is the second benefit. The third benefit, I'm going to give you a homework assignment. Time has run out on me, so I'm going to give you a homework assignment. Read Job 29, 30, and 31. Chapters 29, 30, and 31. Also, read about Elijah, in 1 Kings 18, 1 Kings 19. And also, read the book of Jonah. It's only four chapters long. Read the book of Jonah. Job 29, 30, 31, Elijah, about Elijah, 1 Kings 18 and 19, and read the book of Jonah. Four chapters. That's it. Four chapters. These particular stories will help you to understand that it is important. Here's benefit number three from prayer. Benefit number three from prayer. Those stories will show you and illustrate to you why it's so important that you know how God feels about you. It's important that you're okay with the way God thinks and feels about you. Prayer will help you to get a perspective in that relationship from God to you. From God to you. Don't pray, and guess what? What kind of relationship can you have with a person you don't talk to? Not a very good one. On the physical level, it certainly is quite revealing that, you know, that's fundamental to relationships, communicating. Prayer is all about communication. And also, you know what the additional benefit of knowing how God feels about you and thinks about you is for you? You know what the additional benefit is? Benefit. This is what's in it for you. This is not a feature. I'm a salesman years ago. This is a benefit, not a feature. The benefit for you is that it will help you to erase doubt in your life about God in your life. If you know that God feels good about you, if you've got a good relationship with somebody, doesn't that actually, contrary to doubt, generate trust? Of course it does. And what does trust generate? More reciprocation. It's natural. More reciprocation. Prayer is important, brethren. You want this nation healed? Pray to God, because that's where the answers are to our country's problems. You want answers in your life? Pray to God. These people that Dave mentioned at the beginning of services for prayers, they're asking you to go to God with their names, to pray for them, to appeal on their behalf, and to ask God to be merciful with them and to heal them of the cancer, to heal them of the pain. Do it! We've got to be a praying people. We've got to be a more praying people. This nation needs revival in prayer. I'm not ashamed to say it. It may sound to some people, that's sissified. We need guns. That's what we need. Lock and load, baby. Give me another hand grenade. Pass the ammo, sweetheart. No. We need prayer. We need prayer. Make your protests loud and clear to God and appeal to Him to save the nation He helped build. He did. He did. Once they started praying, it's documented. After Franklin said that appeal to the Congressional Congress, things moved. And out of that, every meeting, out of that appeal, every meeting started with prayer. And from that point on, we got the Constitution we needed out of the Articles of Confederation. And you know what I say to that? Hallelujah! I've been a beneficiary of it. My parents were beneficiaries of it. Your parents, and your parents' parents. Yeah, we've had our ups and downs. It's not a perfect country, nor are we perfect people. And by no means are we a perfect Christian nation. We are a work in progress. And sadly, right now, we are declining in that progression. We're actually regressing now, brethren. We're trying to get God out of the country. What do you think that woman, Barbara Crabb, was trying to do? Unconstitutional National Prayer Day. Boulder Dash. Unconstitutional National Day of Prayer. We could add to prayer, you know that? We could add fasting. We ought to be praying and fasting like Abraham Lincoln called for the nation to do during the Civil War. To bring the healing to the country. But people look at that and poo-poo it and dismiss it and say, that's crazy stuff, man. We're a secular society. We're humanists now, baby. We don't need nothing. We got it made. No, we don't. No, we don't. Remember these three benefits, brethren. Pray. It'll help you. Benefit one, to get close to God. Secondly, it'll help you to get miracles produced in your life. Thirdly, it'll help you to better understand how God feels and thinks about you, which will help you in erasing the doubt in your life about his existence and about his interactivity in your own life and intervention in your own life. And then, in all due respect, let us just pray.